Good morning. I'm Christopher Purdy. Delighted to have your company. This is The Book Show. This is All Sides Weekend Books. We get together usually the third Friday of the month to talk about what everybody is reading, what our panel says you should read with our recommendations. And I am delighted to introduce Chris Hickey, who comes to us from the Columbus Library. And she brings us each month quick picks from the library, those I describe as pretty much the books everybody wants to read, that there's a long line to get on the books. And Chris Hickey is going to tell you how to jump the line. Cassie Rose is WOSU's book critic. There is no show without Cassie Rose. If she tells you to read a book, read the book. Cassie's blog, which is very important to anyone who loves to read, loves books, is thelongestchapter.com. And I am delighted to welcome back my mentor, my friend, my neighbor, OSU Professor Emerita, author, teacher, dancer, singer, Michelle Herman is here. And Michelle, I asked Michelle to come and join us today, and I hope she will be coming back with us because a mentor of hers, in a way, has just passed away. This writer had a couple of very big spreads in the New York Times, one about the process of her dying, which was very beautifully done, and she participated in that. And then a few weeks later, she did pass. I speak of Laurie Siegel. Michelle Herman, tell us about Laurie Siegel.
Ah, Laurie. I've been thinking about her constantly. I think she's going to be remembered as one of the great writers of our time. Not that she was not recognized in her lifetime, but she certainly hasn't gotten the recognition that she deserves, and I think will follow for years to come. She's the most unsentimental, yet deeply full of feeling writer that I know about. There's nothing chilly about her writing. It's funny. Chris, you can testify to that. She's funny, and it's very smart and very sharp, and she mined from her life constantly. You know, she was airlifted out of Vienna, where she was from, when she was 10 years old in 1938 on the Kinder transport. So she was separated from her family. Her parents worked very hard to get that to happen, and she was brought to England and placed with a foster family. And she wasn't reconnected with her mother until she was a teenager. And she went from England to the Dominican Republic. Ultimately, she and her mother both made their way to New York, to the neighborhood that Laurie told me in those days was called Washington Heights.
It's where I lived for many
years.
Yes,
Washington Heights, where my daughter lived for years, too. In those years, it was all refugees, Jews from Eastern Europe who had fled the Nazis. And she married fairly young a publisher named David Siegel. Her original name was Grossman. And they moved to an apartment on the Upper West Side where the rent was exorbitantly high. It was $30-something dollars. And she thought, oh, I don't know if we should do it. And that is actually the apartment that she died in. She lived there all those years. Ultimately, she bought it. There was an apartment for her mother in the same building. Eventually, her son had an apartment in the building. And she helped raise her grandchildren. I don't want to go on and on and on. But she's such a great writer.
She passed away at a great age. She was in her 90s when she passed.
Yeah, she would have been 97 this March.
Laurie Siegel, you brought her here to teach at Ohio State.
Tell
that story.
So I was hired in 1988 to teach at Ohio State. And when I got here, I think I was 33, maybe, and very green. I knew nothing about university life. They dumped a whole bunch of work on me. And one of the things that I was given to do was running the visiting writers program. My students at the time liked to joke that what I wanted to do was bring in dead writers, Chekhov, Tolstoy. But since I couldn't do that, instead, I was bringing in very old writers. And so I made a list of all the writers I admired most, the Czech writer Josef Skvoretsky, who at that time I think was already in his 70s, Tilly Olson,
I met her in your house.
Yes, you did, at that party. Do you remember when she took a chicken home?
I did.
That's a whole other story to tell some other day. But Lori was one of those people. At that time, I thought she was very, very old. She was younger than I am now. I think she was she was 60-something. And I'm about to turn 70, which is very sobering. As you see, I'm not ashamed of it. Anyway, I brought her in because I was dying to meet her, which is the reason I brought all these people in. I'd been reading her in The New Yorker since I was probably 19 or 20 years old. And when I was in graduate school, right before I came to Ohio State, her book, Her First American, came out. And I remember racing to Prairie Lights in Iowa City to buy it and reading it with such joy and fascination. So I invited her to come. She was a tremendous success with the students. She and I bonded instantly. And unlike Tilly Olson, she didn't take a roast chicken home with her to the hotel room. And then I set to work trying to convince her to come here. In 1989, Kathy Fagan and Lee Abbott were hired, and Kathy joined me in a campaign to convince everyone else that we needed to bring Lori here. And while we were doing that, I was convincing Lori to retire from her teaching job. She was retirement age at the University of Illinois in Chicago. I promised her I'd be her best friend. I promised her the moon.
A chicken.
And yeah, I even promised her chickens. And endless conversation. I told she didn't drive, of course. She's a New Yorker. I told her she could live in Olentangy Village. The grocery store was there. She could take the bus if she wanted to, or I would drive her wherever she needed to go. We convinced the department. I convinced Lori. She got here, and I was pregnant. And she settled in just as my baby was born. In fact, my baby was born in June of my baby, she's going to be 32 soon, was born in June of 1993, and Lori gave a reading, a Thurber House picnic reading that summer. It was a way of welcoming her to town, and I brought the baby. She was a month old. It was her first reading and her first outing, and she was dressed in, now Lori's Jewish and I'm Jewish, but Lori bought her a christening gown as a gift just because they're so beautiful. Mm-hmm. So she was in her christening gown and I dressed all in white to match. It was a beautiful event. Anyway, that's how Lori got here. And even though I had a baby, we did become very close friends and remained so. The last time I saw her was only a few months ago. And by then, she was losing her vision. She had been losing her vision. For a while, she was writing with a giant monitor because she could only see a few letters at a time, but she could type. And then she was having someone from Lighthouse for the Blind come and read to her. But toward the end, these final stories she wrote in May and June, she dictated to her daughter and to her daughter-in-law. But she actually communicated with the editor at The New Yorker this summer about changes to the stories. They're beautiful stories. You can read them. They are not behind a paywall in the October 7th New Yorker online. And so she wrote till the very end.
Lori Siegel. We're hearing about Lori Siegel from Michelle Herman, professor emeritus of at The Ohio State University. I'm going to come back to you in the course of the show and ask for recommendations of what people should be reading about her. I want to ask Cassie Rose, first of all, for a recommendation as well before we go to our first break. What do you have for us, Cassie Rose?
I have Richard Flanagan's newest novel called Question 7. People might recognize Flanagan. He wrote The Long Road to the Deep North, which won the Man Booker Prize in 2014. And that was a novel. This is nonfiction, but it does pick up a bit of a theme in that The Long Road was it's a gut-wrenching novel about the POW Japanese experience building the death railway in Burma in Thailand. This book, I mean, his father was a POW in the Japanese war camps. And this book is Flanagan trying to really figure something out. And that's what makes this book so beautiful, is that you can hear his pondering. you can also get the sense of him being vulnerable as he's, and he will just openly say, I don't know why. I don't know why I did this. Such as when the book opens, when he goes to Japan in 2012 to the POW camp where his father was confined in a mine where he was what was called a slave laborer. And he says, I don't know why I went here. I told everyone I came here for a writing reason, he said, but that was just a cover. So there's a man who is giving him the tour, and it turns out he was a guard during the time of his father's imprisonment. And also the media shows up, and he realizes that because he went through councils or whatever to arrange it, that they've figured out what's going on, and they now want this media moment of forgiveness because the guard likely was there when his father was there. And you get his confusion during this, and also he's not judging either, but it sets up the book, this book that is more than about that, because he talks about a Hungarian physicist who was part of had a role in the development of the atom bomb. And part of that is if the bomb had not been dropped on Hiroshima, his father probably would not be alive today, and Richard Flanagan would not be here. So all of these moral and ethical questions. He also writes about H.G. Wells and his love affair with Rebecca West, because Wells wrote a book that influenced the physicist. And he writes about growing up in Tasmania in the rainforests. It's really a remarkable book, and it's very powerful, and it's one that, for me, it's not that it was a page-turner. It was that this book is part of my week, and along with everything else in my life, and I just want to be with this book. I was fascinated about how he also has this premise, or he asks this question, and he says, you know, we all want to pull this thread out of the tapestry of our life to ask why, all of the scenes that are going to fall together, why in that? And that's part of what's going on here that sets up why he goes through all of the different narratives. But then you get to question 7, which he details on page 24, which comes from Anton Chekhov. And essentially, it's not giving anything away, but I'll just say, it's, you know, who loves longer, and why do we do to each other what we do? It is a phenomenal book. Very, very good. And I highly recommend it.
Question 7 by Richard Flanagan.
Yes.
Someone you've read before?
Yes, I have read his book. Now, here's the thing. I read his book, Wanting, which came out before the Long Road book. And because it underwhelmed me, Wanting did. I didn't pick up this Booker Award winning. So I missed that and now have that on my reading table after I've read this one.
A recommendation from Cassie Rose, who is WOSU's book critic. Her blog is thelongestchapter.com. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend Books. We are going to take a quick break and come on back with more discussion. Don't go away.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
We are back. Welcome back to All Sides Weekend Books, the book show, the third Friday of the month, usually. I'm Christopher Purdy. Thank you for your company. I'm here with Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic, Michelle Herman, professor emeritus at The Ohio State University, and Chris Hickey from the... Are you back at Whetstone?
I'm back at Whetstone.
Chris Hickey from the Columbus Public Library, now back at the Whetstone branch where she belongs, so we can go in the neighborhood and say hello to her. Chris brings us every month quick picks from the library, which are what?
So quick picks are the hot books with long hold lists. So we buy extra copies. They're coded a little bit different. That's a behind the scenes thing. You may not care. But they don't go out on holds. So when you come into the building, we have a display of them and you can check them out, jump the line. So you might be, you know, hundreds of people in front of you. You can walk into one of our buildings and the book that you want will hopefully be there. You grab it, check it out.
And just the housekeeping, it's every Tuesday they add the new ones. Is that
yes,
right?
Every Tuesday. Tuesdays are release dates, and that's where you will find the brand new QuickBooks.
And the same ones at every branch.
Same ones at every branch.
Okay. Yes. What do you got for us?
So I have the new Louise Erdrich. So this is called the Mighty Red, and I love Louise Erdrich. So this novel takes place in the Red River Valley of North Dakota, and it is about a fraught wedding. So it's a huge cast of characters. And we have Gary, who is the groom, and he is a very stressed out man who stands to inherit two beet farms. He's not Dwight Schrute from The Office, not that kind of beet farm, but two large beet farms. The bride, her name is Kismet, and she is a former goth girl. There's a man named Hugo, who is a gentle giant, and he is in love with Kismet, and he wants to steal her, and he is planning to, he wants to challenge Gary to a duel. So we'll see if that actually pans out. Crystal is Kismet's mother, and she's the first character that we meet in this story. So she hauls beets for Gary's family's farm.
You mean the veg beets?
Beets, like okay.
Didn't
the vegetable
beets. Did she write a book called The Beet Queen?
She might have. She knows a lot about beets. Yes.
Years ago.
Yes. Yeah. She actually was worked as a farmhand when she was a teenager. So she does have experience, you know, in the region.
I have to interject that one of my former students is about to publish a book called Beta Vulgaris. That's fantastic. It was her thesis. I directed it. And it is about working in the beet fields. And it's a literary horror story about a murderous beet pile. Margie Sarsfield, Beta. It's such a good book. I'll remind you.
That could be a great reading experience. You read The Mighty Red, and then you've got a murderous beet farm.
It's a beautiful book, and not normally my thing, but I loved it so much.
So Crystal is driving at night, and she listens to a lot of talk radio. And so this particular night, the show is about angels. And so a caller calls in, I think that my son has a guardian angel. And she describes how he's had these near-death experiences with a mountain lion. He fell into a grain pile. And Crystal just rolls her eyes because she knows this voice. This woman is in her book club and she knows all about it. This is Gary's mother. So she, you know, is listening to her book club. I don't know if they're friends. And wondering, you know, his great luck, how is that going to impact her daughter if this relationship continues? And so she worries about that. So this book takes place during the economic meltdown of 2008-2009. There are a lot of details about farming in this book. So if you're interested in that, you will learn something. And I that's what I love about books like that is I like learning something. I don't know much about farming, so I'm learning about that. It is very much a climate change novel. So there'll be a lot going on with that.
That sounds like it's a departure for her. And a lot of her work has been about her, hasn't it been about her Native American background?
Yes, that is also.
That's a big part of this too.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, definitely.
Because thematically, that's what's.
By Louise Erdrich, right?
By Louise Erdrich. Yes.
No, that's.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm done.
Yeah.
Yes.
Give us one more.
Okay, let's do a spooky one since we're in October. This is called Model Home, and it is by Rivers Solomon. So Rivers Solomon is known for her novel The Deep, and that was the novel about mer people who were the descendants of pregnant slaves who were drowned on the transatlantic. But I mean, my coworkers that read it said it was phenomenal. It was a fantastic sci-fi type of book. This is a haunted house book. So this is about the Maxwell family who moves to a wealthy, mostly white gated community near Dallas. And once they move in, strange things start to happen. And the mother says, "We are not moving. Trials and trauma be damned. We are staying in this house." And so Esri, who is gender nonconforming, they and their siblings have left the house and get word that their parents have died. How they get word is very mysterious. And the siblings don't want to go back and investigate because they believe that this house is haunted and that the house has killed their parents. So Esri returns to investigate. And so what we get is we get a history of the siblings, we get a history of the house. Esri's memories are very dreamlike, somewhat unreliable, so it's hard to tell what's real and what isn't. So it's a good spooky. It's less than 300 pages, so it's a quick spooky read. But I think it's interesting. River Solomon shared that when they were young and they lived in Dallas, their mother would take them to visit model homes in swanky neighborhoods. So that experience kind of translates into this book as well.
My mother used to do that too.
Yes, it's really fun.
She'd sign in a fake name. That's a quick pick, Model Home from Chris Hickey.
Model Home by River Solomon.
Quick pick from the Columbus Library. You are listening. I'm talking. You're listening to All Sides Weekend Books here on 89.7 NPR News. Michelle Herman, you were talking to us early about Laurie Siegel, the great writer who passed away, I think, about 2 weeks ago now, at the age of nearly 97. And she, apparently, as you said, she was working until she drew her
almost,
last breath, pretty much.
Yeah.
Tell me about, if I wanted to begin, if I didn't know her work, and I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, I need to experience this writer, where do I begin? What am I reading?
Well, you know, so many people go to the story, The Reverse Bug. It's a beautiful short story that was originally published in The New Yorker. It's a kind of shattering story where people at a kind of think tank hear, I don't want to give too much away, but hear the voices coming from the walls of the people who died in Dachau and Auschwitz and so on. But the thing about that story is it's an anomaly. It's the only sort of supernatural story Laurie ever wrote. It got her a lot of attention. And it's a great story, but I wouldn't say that that's the place to begin because it's not like anything else she wrote. That story itself, though, is part of a novel in stories called Shakespeare's Kitchen, which gives the story more context. But that, too, is not the place I'd begin. I would begin, as I told Christopher right after Laurie died, with her First American, the novel that was published in, I think, 1985. I know it was between 84 and 86 because that's when I was in Iowa City. And that is, like everything Laurie wrote, based to some extent on her own experience. When she first came to the United States as a young woman, she met a journalist whose name in real life I can't remember, and I think that's just as well. He was much older. He was a black man, and he was an alcoholic. And she got involved with him, was involved with him for a long time. And she always told me, all those years later when we were friends, that she always had a kind of magnetic attraction toward otherness, which she suggested I had too because I married a Southern Baptist. But she based the novel in part on her relationship with that man, her first American. In the book, his name is Carter Bayou, and the young woman is Ilka, who is in The Reverse Bug and is in all of Shakespeare's Kitchen and who appears, comes and goes in Laurie's work.
Question.
Yes.
Ilka's last name is Weissnichts.
Yes.
Know nothing.
Yes.
Why would she?
Because she knew nothing.
Knew
and
nothing.
I mean,
okay.
It's so interesting. Laurie's characters who are based on her are always based on a piece of her, a piece of her biography more than anything else. Ilka was an innocent in a way that Laurie never was. And Ilka fumbled for words in a way that Laurie never did. And in fact, I want to say, like, I can't tell you how much I love that novel, but I love just as much Laurie's last book, her most recent book, which came out only last year. It's called Ladies' Lunch. Mm-hmm. And the latest stories in The New Yorker could very well have been included in that book had she written them then. But it's about a group of women, of old, old women who have been meeting regularly for lunch for decades in New York, something that Laurie, in fact, did. And what fascinated me as I read them, and I'm not going to give names because I don't know if that's appropriate to do, but the real-life women that Laurie had those lunches with were a group of intellectual women. I mean, they would get together to read. They had a book club. They didn't read a new novel. They read James Joyce or they read Shakespeare. Those are the things they would read to talk about. Anyway, I can identify parts of each of those women, including Laurie. She splits herself into multiple parts. She's a little bit like Bridget is part Laurie, and now I'm going to forget all their names. Each of them is some of Laurie and some of the other women, all of whom I know or know of. It's a beautiful book. None of you have read it yet, right? You will love it. Cassie just picked it up. Yes. She has a copy. I love it so much. So I would say if I were you, I would read her First American. And if you like it, as I'm sure you will, I would then read Lady's Lunch and then work your way through. Her first novel, Other People's Houses, is a masterpiece. It's an autobiographical novel about a girl named Laurie and her family in Vienna. Her novel, Lucianella, takes place at an artist colony. It's a slim, tiny little book that's gorgeous. Half a Kingdom takes place in Manhattan at a hospital where everybody who goes into the ER develops dementia. I mean, I just recommend it all. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention her children's books. Two of the best children's books I have ever read, which I cannot wait to give to my future grandchildren that Christopher keeps thinking I already have. Tell Me a Trudy and Tell Me a Mitzi take place in Manhattan, and they're just very young children picture books. She also did translations of Grimm's fairy tales. And anyway, just read her. Read everything.
Why do you think that I've read that Lucianella is a cult classic?
Yeah.
Why does it get
because
that
it's a
descriptor?
Because it's a writer's book. Like, writers... Alison Lurie also published an artist's colony novel called Real People that has a similar sort of status. Part of it is guessing who the various artists are. I mean, I wrote very much thinking about, in fact, do I have time for an anecdote about Lurie and writing?
Sure.
When Lurie was teaching here, I taught a seminar in retellings, which I always enjoyed teaching, which Nick actually took over for me and has taught since. And one of the stories I taught was Chekhov's The Lady with the Pet Dog, which is, I think, my favorite all-time short story about an affair. And I taught it along with Joyce Carol Oates's extremely flawed retelling. But I was very frustrated because my students, who are graduate students, did not get the Chekhov story. They kept saying things like, why didn't they just get divorced, this couple? Like, not getting the 19th century. And I was having dinner with Laurie at the old Taj Mahal, and I was complaining to her, and she said, well, what do you think the story is about? And I said, I think it's about the redemptive power of love. And Laurie said, nonsense! There is no redemptive power. This is very Laurie. There is no such thing as redemptive power of love. So I went home and began a novella that was my own retelling of The Lady with the Pet Dog. My plan was to give it to Laurie because it was going to be about the redemptive power of love and to give it to my students. But because in those days I wrote very slowly, it took me a year and a half to write the novella. It was too late for those students. They'd graduated and moved on. Laurie was grudgingly appreciative. And in 1998, I published that along with two other novellas in a book called A New and Glorious Life is a line from the very end of the Chekhov. And I don't think that one's a cult item. I don't think enough people have read it. But I do think it belongs in that category of these unusual books that take place where artists are sequestered together.
Like Mary McCarthy did too in the book Oasis.
Yes, exactly. Yes. That's another one. Mm-hmm. If I thought about it long enough, I could probably put together a seminar in. I read one recently and now I can't remember. I took it out of the Whetstone Library. You know, Chris is my librarian. And I found it I hadn't heard of it, in the new, that's another section that's worth going to at Whetstone, just the new fiction.
Right.
And, you know, there we go.
Right. Cassie Rose, I want a recommendation from you as we continue All Sides Weekend Books. We have a few minutes on this side of a break, so start. If we have to come back, we will, okay?
Sure, but first, I am compelled that I need to make a correction. It is not the long road to the deep north. It's the narrow road to the deep north.
Is that a Freudian slip?
I wrote it down wrong. I'll get it there. Okay.
Anyway, so I am going to recommend a book called A Way to Be Happy, and it is a collection of short stories. There are eight stories. They're absolutely marvelous by Caroline Anderson. And what she does in these stories, you have this situation that will happen. Maybe it's an ordinary situation, whatever. But always in each of the stories, there's a not a second element, but it's a third element that comes in. And it's like a portal of light that really speaks to this way to happiness.
This is what I need to read.
It is a perfect book if you want to read, if you're the kind of person who wants to read before you go to bed at night. For example, she has characters like there's some drug addicts that are going to high-end New Year's Eve parties and stealing the purses. And the woman walks into the bedroom and where all the purses and coats are and is surprised to find a woman is there nursing her baby. Or there is a woman who leaves her husband for, she can't give him a reason why. She's in her 60s. She just says, I need a separation.
I'm done.
Yeah, right. She says, I'm done. She goes to a remote town and none of the neighbors will speak with her or engage with her. They're just they're not social. And she wakes up one morning and her roof is covered with homing pigeons. And there's another story where it's a young boy who is teased in his high school, and he falls for this prank where you either have to do something that nobody wants to do or you have to give a donation. And he doesn't know what the donation is. And the girls tease him and say, well, he's going to have to give his sperm. And he's, you know, doofy enough to think that that's really what's going on. And what they do, though, is they swab his mouth. Well, it is, and he doesn't know what's going on. Well, years later, there is something that happens that for him, his life is, it's not gone poorly, but not really well. That portal that opens up is a connection to a person that benefits from this donation that he ends up giving from the DNA connection. I don't want to give that away, but all of it has to do with interaction with another person. That is where that happiness comes from.
And complete with mouth swabs, the book is called A Way to Be Happy.
A Way to Be Happy,
a collection of short stories by
Caroline Anderson.
A recommendation from Cassie Rose, who was WOSU's book critic. We're going to take one more break and come back for more of All Sides Weekend Books. Don't go away.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
We are back. All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy here with Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic, Michelle Herman, professor emeritus at The Ohio State University, author, singer, dancer, teacher. She has been telling us about Laurie Siegel, a great writer who passed away very recently at the age of 96, telling us how we can really enjoyed some of the extraordinary writing of this woman. And Chris Hickey from the Whetstone branch of the Columbus Library. You are the Youth Services Manager. That's your official title. And you come to us every month with quick picks, those books everybody wants to read but has to wait for, except if Chris Hickey tells you how to jump the line.
You jump the line, you come in, you can do this in any of our buildings. We have quick pick displays. Grab it, check it out, and you can jump in front of other people.
You get up in 30 days or something like that.
You get it for 21 days. So the difference between a quick pick and another circulating title is this will definitely not renew.
Okay, so what
so
do you have
do have
for
to
us?
Bring it back.
Give us a quick pick.
I have the new Malcolm Gladwell book.
Okay.
This is called Revenge of the Tipping Point, Overstories, Super Spreaders, and the Rise of Social Engineering. So Malcolm Gladwell in 2002 wrote his first book, which was called The Tipping Point. And so a tipping point, let me just read the definition, is that critical moment when an idea, trend, or behavior crosses a threshold and spreads like wildfire. And one of the things that I love about him is in this book, he starts to tell you a story about a phenomenon, and then he will take you on a side journey as another illustration of the point that he's trying to make. And then he will tie them both together. It's fun. So there, he talks about Medicare fraud that's happening in Miami. So why Miami? What is the overstory of Miami? And his side journey is he looks at the phenomenon of the anti-vaccination movement that's taking place in a particular group of private schools. And he kind of ties the culture of the two things and why are these, why do things run rampant in these areas? And then he kind of brings that back together and explains why. Another chapter that's, all the chapters are fascinating, but he talks about a place called Poplar Grove, which has been written about in other places. It's a high-performing community. Everyone's kind of the same. So, you know, people are like at the top of their careers, their children are 4.0, president of this, captain of this, and just like very, he calls it a monoculture. And what has happened in this community is they have a higher rate of teenage suicides, which is tragic and awful. His side story for this one is about cheetahs, which you would think they would have nothing to do with each other. But he talks about how they, cheetahs are genetically undiverse. So if a cheetah becomes ill in a cat, you know, a cat sanctuary or a zoo, they'll all fall because of the genetic undiversity. So he talks about them both as monocultures and the danger of monocultures. And that I found fascinating. And that the same principles are causing problems in Poplar Grove. So where everyone's the same, if someone is struggling, it's not a good thing. And so that you've got that higher rate of teenage suicide, which is just awful.
That's the latest from Malcolm Gladwell.
This is the latest from Malcolm Gladwell. And he knows he's poking the bear. He has plenty of critics. Mm. He does not mind, but he's happy to poke the bear. And he goes after higher education, too. So,
He
pokes bears.
Well, thank you, The Ohio State University. Thank you very much, Michael Monk. Give us one more.
Okay, let's talk about Ina Garten. So she's the barefoot Contessa.
I see this woman's name everywhere.
And she's everywhere.
She planting a garden. Who is she?
Who is she? Okay, if you don't know who Ina Garten is, she has a huge following. She's on the Food Network. She is a best-selling cookbook author. All kinds of things. Yes, there's cupcakes too. So she bought a specialty food store in the Hamptons named the Barefoot Contessa and turned it into just an empire. And so this is her memoir. And I was surprised what I learned by this book. I thought I knew her. I watched her. You know, I love her cookbooks. I've watched her show. She grew up abused. She has, a very troubled relationship with her parents. Her father told her no one would ever love her. But then she said, I walk down the street and people tell me they love me. So he was wrong, which I thought was pretty great. But she talked about how in her family, they, you know, ate for nutrition only and there was no joy in food.
Yeah.
So she felt she spent her life searching for flavors and did not expect to own a shop or anything like that. But she was very unhappy in her career. And when that she saw an ad for that, she thought, well, maybe I could just do something different. And it spawned this whole thing. Another thing that's interesting about her is her cookbook. Her cookbooks all have many glossy photographs in them, and she had to fight the publisher for that. They did not want to put pictures in the cookbook, and she fought them and won, and it was a runaway hit.
But she is everywhere. I mean,
she is everywhere.
She created an empire. But she's like Martha Stewart. Maybe she's nicer, though. I mean,
she might be. I get the sense from this book that she is. And her relationship with her husband Jeffrey is very famous. And she talks about their struggles. They separated for a time, and she's very open about that, and how they worked through things and became stronger.
Good
and she's
her.
Very open about why she didn't want to have children. So she talks about that in this book as well.
Well, I mean, sticking with a marriage and fixing a marriage yourself, I think is a great reason to read the book.
Yes. Yeah. And she said, I'm writing this book because maybe some things that I've learned will be helpful to other people.
Ina Garten, right?
Ina Garten.
Ina Garten. Not in your
the
garden,
barefoot
but
contestant.
Ina Garten.
Ina Garten.
Okay. A recommendation. That's a quick pick from the Columbus Library. So look for it on the display in any of the library branches.
Yes.
The Columbus Library, and the new titles are added on Tuesday mornings.
That's
right?
Correct.
Okay. Cassie Rose, give us a recommendation.
You know, I'm going to recommend a book that I spent, I want to say about the last 3 months reading, 4 months reading. I did sort of like, Christopher, what you do, reading 10 pages a day.
Is there cupcakes in it?
No, there are no cupcakes, but it's 611 pages. But here's the thing. I told myself that this year I'm going to be reading the books on my reading table that are the huge page numbers. I'm not going to just keep dreamily looking at them. So this was one of them. And it is the biography of Saul Bellow. And I was absolutely captivated by this book. Even just reading, I'd read 10 pages a day. I'd even go maybe a week. And it was like I was watching a series on Netflix or something, because every time I would go back to it, I was captivated by this character. And that's a testament to the biographer James Atlas, because he brings Saul Bellow, this genius author, to life, and his emotional life with the city of Chicago.
Not to mention his emotional life with all those wives.
Right. He was married five times. Yes. He really wanted to have the stability and this of marriage and the companionship, but he could not make the commitment. And he's famously known for intimately intertwining his personal life and his work life. So in his novels, Herzog and Humboldt's Gift, he pretty much had a lot of characters that were based on the people in his life. And actually also in Ravelstein and Sandler's Planet, or Mr. Sandler's Planet. The thing about it is, again, he came to life for me in the way that that James Atlas showed his emotions and his struggles, and how he, in starting out in a family that did not support him, they were, his brothers became successful businessmen, a little corrupt in Chicago, but successful. And they thought what he was doing was a waste of time. He had no support from them, but he did have support from the University of Chicago and Northwestern literary groups that he had formed. And the thing is that he loved, the chaos made him function, especially in his writing life. I mean, after five marriages, five divorces, the ex-wives coming after him, which actually, again, in Herzog and Humboldt's life, the ex-wives in there pretty much patterned what he was going through. But anyway, he thrived on it. He wrote from 9 in the morning to 1 in the afternoon. And even though the lawyers were coming after him and the ex-wives coming after him and all this, when I got to the end of the book, I was so sad that it was ending. I kind of felt like I'd spent this vacation with a good friend of mine all summer, and now I had to leave and go home.
And you didn't have to marry him.
I didn't have
Or be his child.
Yeah. Or be his child.
Have you read all of his books?
Not all of them.
Well, then you can keep it going. Yes. I will say, Herzog, looking back at it now, some of his misogyny, all of his misogyny makes me crazy, but Herzog, I think, is the book that influenced me most as a writer, that kind of taught me to do the kind of writing that I do. I loved that novel. And Seize the Day, the novella, is really, I think, one of the great pieces of literature of the 20th century.
And Herzog, when it hit the bestseller list and it pushed out Jean Le Carré's The Spy That
Thank
Came In
goodness.
From the Cold.
So, well, Bellow was the rare writer who was, you know, a high literary writer who did make the bestseller list. He was my hero, and then the cracks began to show.
And the misogyny is, I mean, he does. Vivian Gornick just came after him in, it was a brilliant essay, I think, maybe in the New York Review of Books or somewhere. And I think it's just the cultural component of, you know, Philip Roth writing during that time.
It is, but I find it very difficult to go back and read Bellow and Roth now, who were my North Star and whatever the correspondent. I mean, I loved those writers so much growing up, and it's just painful and unpleasant.
Philip Roth, I knew his stepdaughter. Oy, you know what I mean?
I mean, both of them were not good guys.
No.
But great writers.
Yeah, indeed they were. Mm-hmm. So why did you choose to read that 10 pages at a time and not dig into it? I'm just curious.
I think it's that because it's amount of books that I still need to read, and to devote myself to it, I'd get behind in my other reading. That's why I have to be careful with the 600 page books. I have to read them while I'm reading other books. I was going to say unless they're new, but then still, it's just hard. I'm a slow reader.
Well, good for you. But you savor things and you remember them, which I don't, which is, you know, this is why
I don't either. I read very fast.
I keep lists of what I read every year, and I have to always include, like, the reviews of something so I can click on something and remember
what
I
wrote. Remember what it was,
Because a week later, I don't remember it anymore, which is terrible. Michelle Herman, I want to ask you before we finish, what are you writing now? I know you've retired from teaching full-time at The Ohio State University. You have several books to your credit. And I've told you this before, and you're tired of hearing it. I don't care, because the most beautiful novella I've ever read is called Missing, and it's written by Michelle Herman. It might have been your first.
It was my first, a million years ago.
I read it in New York before I ever met you, before I ever came here. And if you want to read an absolutely beautiful novella, it's called, very simple title, Missing by Michelle Herman. Get it. What are you writing now?
So I've got a new book coming out at the end of March. It's my 10th, and it's called If You Say So, and it's a collection of essays that are set in Columbus, that are about, I don't know, I guess, grief and loss and joy and the way these experiences live in the body. And so that'll be out in the end of March. I'm doing events in Columbus in April. I have a novel for middle grade readers that is making its way around to publishers, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed about
that. I've read
that.
It. It's wonderful.
Yes, Chris has read it for
It's absolutely wonderful.
Well, so far, the book
needs to come out.
The publishers keep saying it's too quiet, which just drives me crazy. Books are supposed to be quiet.
There's nothing wrong with having a quiet book for children.
Beautiful.
Absolutely nothing.
Yeah, of course. Yes. And before I forget, you're not Dear Abby, but you're Dear Michelle. You're an advice columnist.
Every Sunday.
And listen, and if you're a guy misbehaving, you got no mercy from this woman. I'm telling you this right now. Go ahead.
I can be very tough. I'm an advice columnist every Sunday in Slate by 9 in the morning. There's my advice. It's the Care and Feeding column. And I love it. It's my favorite side hustle I've ever done. Yeah.
What are people writing to you? I mean, what are they?
I mean, it's everything. I mean, it's everything from my child just came out as trans, I don't know what to do, to last week, my wife and I are arguing about what to do with the Halloween candy. I mean, because the husband.
How did you answer them?
This is great. The husband wants the kid to be able to eat all the Halloween candy he wants to, just like he did when he was a child. And the wife wants 20 pieces and the rest get given away at the office.
Oh, no.
And they're battling over this to the point that the wife threatens a divorce. So, of course, my answer was you don't have a Halloween candy problem. You have a marriage problem.
It's not the candy.
But it is. It started out as a parenting column. I mean, care and feeding in general. There are other care and feeding columnists. But it has become kind of a relationship column. I get questions about friendship. The one that's coming out this Sunday has two questions about friendship. I love doing it. It's made me a faster writer. I now just, like, I wrote that kid's novel in just a couple of months.
How do you, are the questions chosen for you from the submissions, or do you get to choose?
I can choose my questions. Yeah. And I leave questions about potty training and sleep training to other people to deal with, because my answer would always be patient.
Right. They'll learn.
I mean, eventually, unless your child has a disability, they're going to learn to use the toilet. So don't bother me with this. I'm also the only one who takes on the LGBTQ+ questions.
Right.
So that's become a sort of, someone was just asking me if I want to put together a book of my, I have a friend whose child is trans, and she said, you know, she relies on my answers about that. Maybe I could compile them all. And I got a lot going on.
That's a wonderful idea. Would really fill a need for people.
I know, I'm supposed to be retired, but every single minute of every day, I haven't gotten any writing done in weeks because there's been so much
to do. Giving too much advice. I'm Christopher Purdy. This has been All Sides Week in Books. My thanks to Michelle Herman. My thanks to Chris Hickey. My thanks to Cassie Rose. My thanks to Cam Howard for putting us on the air and running the board. My thanks to you all for listening. Keep reading. This is 89.7 WOSU Public Media. Thank you.